I'm pleased to introduce the first of our keynote speakers, Lynette Nussbacher. You have a bio for her in your program, but I will say a few things about her. She's principal at Nussbacher & Associates, which is a strategy development consultancy. But as you'll also know from the bio, she was head of the Strategic Horizons Unit at the Cabinet Office. She was devil's advocate at the Joint Intelligence Committee, a senior lecturer at Sandhurst, served as an officer in the British Army and the Canadian Forces. And I know, because she's prolific on Facebook, that she's also skilled with medieval weaponry, which hopefully will not be a skill that she needs here today. So I give you Lynette.
That's very kind of you, Rex. I always appreciate the wind-up. And my title is There's No Pro Like an Old Pro. And that's because the really content-rich title, Towards an Effective Wargaming Profession, or if I want to be very polite, Towards a More Effective Wargaming Profession, is not a title calculated to enthuse. One of the issues that I have encountered over a number of years is difficulty in gaining traction for gaming and simulation, especially in a policy environment. The idea that it might be difficult to get traction for wargaming or simulation in a policy environment will come as no surprise to a lot of people in this room. There will be some people here who say to themselves, I have no trouble at all. All I need to do is set out my stall and people listen to me, and I congratulate you. And the reason that it is worth talking about wargaming, gaming and simulation in a policy environment is because it is a way of introducing unplanned or discontinuous events into policy development and into strategy making. That's why I do it, and that's a reason why it is useful. This is a little bit relevant. Just yesterday, I was talking to a client, and we were trying to figure out what the Prime Minister is planning to do next. And the client said, I really don't understand what he's planning to do next. I said, well, he's going to try to have an election next. And the response was, why does he want to have an election next? And I said, well, because his plan is, next step, have an election, win the election, and then achieve my policy aims. And the idea in UK government that policy and plans always work underlies this way of doing business. And that is enormously significant. Plans are viewed, policies are viewed in UK government as models of reality. And they are viewed as linear progressions from conception of a policy, a development of policy, a development of plans, execution of plans, achieving of goals. It is a linear process. And it is also linear in the sense that inputs are proportional to outcomes. If you put a lot of effort into policy, or God help us, strategy, then what you get out of it will be proportional to what you put into it. This linearity, of course, exists largely in the minds of elected officials. To some extent, it does exist in the minds of senior professional civil servants. And the more senior people are, arguably, the more they're willing to see this linearity between policy design, policy planning, and policy effect. There was a time when I was in the Canadian Army many years ago when I was learning how to be a staff officer, and I spent a lot of time working on something called the staff operational planning process. And the staff operational planning process was an enormous flowchart designed to enable a corps, an army corps, and when you say Canadian Army and Army Corps in the same breath, you know you're stepping away from the realm of gritty reality. It was to enable a Canadian Army Corps, no doubt operating on the inner German border to stop Ivan and all that, to enable it to make a decision in only 72 hours. And the 72-hour core planning cycle included a phase that was the wargaming phase. And the wargaming phase was when you've got a matrix telling you the enemy's courses of action, of which there are only ever three, of course. There is the most likely, the least likely, and the most dangerous. When you've got these three, the most likely, by the way, is the one that the commander intuitively thinks is going to happen based on the sum of either the sum of his biases, the sum of his fears, or some combination thereof. Least likely is the one that the commander is secretly afraid of and wishes to be put out of consideration because it's too unpleasant to look at. And least likely is usually something comical that you make up in order to direct everyone to most likely. Now, and I've just caricatured them, but I don't think I'm far off in the way that those three assessments were applied. And then the way these would all be rigorously tested to ensure they weren't biased in the way that I've just said is you'd wargame each one. And one of the first things I learned as a young staff officer was that you never actually wargame them. And it was always because there is no time to wargame in a 72-hour decision-making cycle. This is significant because, first of all, I've been assured by almost every commander and every senior staff officer I've worked with since then, that was in the early 1990s, that was then, this is now, and there's always rigorous wargaming of all possible enemy courses of action now. But also because it demonstrates that prioritizing simulation and gaming is not always quite as tough as we'd like. That prioritization sometimes slips, and that's significant. And I want to talk a little bit about why. But first I want to talk about what an important purpose of gaming and simulation is in a policy development, strategy development environment. A lot of what I do in making strategy, now largely in a corporate environment, is structured strategy making, which starts with horizon scanning. And one of the reasons that you do that, or that you introduce wargaming into a strategy or policy development process, is to inoculate against strategic shock or other forms of shock. What is shock in this context? It is cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance that arises from the unprepared encounters with the unexpected. One of the most interesting and engaging ways to read military history in the 20th century, early 20th century, is to pick up Norman Dixon on the psychology of military incompetence. And Dixon is a Freudian psychiatrist who analyzes senior, mostly British commanders who are considered either competent or in, and brings in some of the psychological reasons in the framework of Freudian theory which made them situationally incompetent. And one of the things that he talks about is the way that commanders deal with cognitive dissonance. And the way they deal with cognitive dissonance is largely, according to Dixon, predictable from the point of view of a psychiatrist, That is, when you encounter an idea for which you are unprepared, or an idea that challenges your biases a little too much, you stop thinking effectively. You stop paying attention to inputs. And he gives some fascinating examples of this. It's really worth reading, partly because it is such an interesting way to look at military history, and partly because he challenges some things that we like to think of as straightforward and sound. And when we look at the way that policy is formed, and when I say policy, I'm talking about policy, the way policy is formed in government, especially UK government, but also the way that the equivalent types of policy are formed in a corporate environment. There is very little inoculation against shock, against cognitive dissonance. People are not prepared to think about complex and difficult outcomes that challenge their biases. And as a result, people tend to run their decision-making processes, their policy development, their plans for the future along very narrow rails. They don't like to get out of their comfort zone. And there was a point when I was doing a job, and this was in the cabinet office, that was based on an Israeli concept. And the idea was that I was meant to be devil's advocate for the Joint Intelligence Committee, as Rex said earlier. And the paper that my job was based on, I was the first incumbent in the job, so it was not based on what anybody had done before. It was based on a paper written after an interview with a guy called Kashi. And Shlomo Kashi is an Israeli intelligence officer, spent many years in the IDF intelligence branch and then in their secret intelligence organization. And Kashi said that you need to challenge intelligence assessment, and you need to do so within a structure. And that the structure needs to be led by a colonel with no career prospects. He said, it's got to be a colonel because unless it's somebody with reasonable seniority, they won't get anything done. And it's got to be somebody whose career is going nowhere because challenge, which is the basis of red teaming, of inoculation against strategic shock, all of these ideas, and indeed, to some extent, wargaming. Challenge makes you unpopular. And after I'd been doing this job for a while, I did go to my boss and I said, John, I see that this foundation document quotes Kashi saying that you need a clapped out colonel going nowhere to do this job. I said, why'd you hire me? And he looked at me. Then the penny dropped, which is a reason I don't work in government anymore. The idea that being awkward is part of inoculating against strategic shock, part of challenge, and therefore a necessary part of policy development is an uncomfortable one. And this is relevant to gaming and simulation because almost by nature, unless gaming and simulation is heavily loaded to appeal to bias, and you can, of course, you can design simulations to be a confirmation bias simulation where everybody is warmly patted and assured that everything they expect will come to pass. Anybody who's done major military exercises has seen this, where you have an exercise in which, you know, nobody ever runs out of fuel and aims tend to be achieved, and you reset if things get if the unexpected happens. You can organize things that way, but gamers and simulation designers rarely want to design things that way, and that's because at its base, simulation and gaming introduce disruptive elements into processes. That's what they're for, and that's what they do best. UK government has a concept of policy that is at odds with this way of thinking and this way of working. I went to a presentation years ago by the head of the policy profession in UK government. And the policy profession consists of people who have what's called a policy head. And a policy head is effectively the ability to turn a ministerial whim into one side of A4 that sets out something that government is going to achieve. And policy specialists, by and large, are people whose skill set enables them to comparatively uncritically address what a minister wants to do, a secretary of state wants to do, and make it seem as though it is a well thought out concept. And what this fellow said, the head of this profession said, was that the goal of policy in UK government was to execute strategy. And he said it without laughing or making a face or anything like that. And I had to conclude that he meant it. And that is that rather than anything I'd learned over years of learning about strategy, which is that strategy executes policy, it was all backwards in government. This helped me understand why, certainly in the realm of military strategy, UK armed forces have always been so crippled. Because if the rest of government thinks that policy executes strategy, then the idea of developing strategy to execute policy is something that people hadn't been trained for, never been asked to do, and when the idea came up, they were utterly ill-equipped. That felt perfectly safe. I understood that. But the difficult thing was trying to figure out how a government operates in which strategy is the overall, overarching way to achieve aims, and policy a mechanistic way to achieve that. One solution which I thought might address that was to try to create a strategy profession in government. And I went to the guy who was then running the strategy unit, a very bright fellow, very personable, very open-minded, and I suggested to him that we have a strategy profession in government. I ran into him a few months ago and reminded him of this. He had absolutely no memory of anybody proposing a strategy profession in government. And I'm convinced that's because of cognitive dissonance. The idea of a strategy profession is alien in a world in which strategy is, as it were, presumed to exist. And policy is really the way things get done. But it is no surprise to me at all that in an environment in which there is no structured approach to achieving policy aims, that which we might call strategy, that there is no strategy profession. And this is because structured development, structured means of deciding how to marshal ends and how to marshal ways and means in order to achieve ends, that is the basis of strategy, in an environment in which there is no structured way of doing that. The idea that a linear progression from ministerial whim, or indeed, to be a little kinder, a social need or a political need, going from a political rationale to finished policy to successfully executed policy to bettering people's lives or whatever else it is government wants to do. Doing that has to become a linear process. It has to be conceived of as a process whereby you get the idea, you write up a side of A4 of policy, or you have a young fast streamer write up a side of A4 of policy. You hand it to people and say, execute this, and you genuinely expect that you will get the results that you asked for. That is the only way to work if you don't take a structured view of strategy. There are other countries, the United States comes to mind, that suffer from this less. Fascinatingly, the United States has a strong think tank sector, to some extent because its system of politically appointing senior government officials, down to it, by UK standards, a very low level, creates an economic requirement for finding jobs for people whose political party cannot give them a government job. And as a result, they've got a strong, a robust think tank sector filled with people who do a lot of rigorous policy development. It is no accident that the granddaddy of American think tanks, that RAND, is all about the wargaming, because there is every incentive for the people who are going to provide senior government officials going forward, and advice to senior government officials going forward, to be nonlinear, to assume that whatever it is that the government is trying to do today is a bad idea, because the nature of politically appointed senior civil servants, or the equivalent, is that that half the think tank sector is trying to be critical of them. The UK has a very weak think tank sector, and a very new think tank sector. That is, the Policy Exchange is, 15 years old, perhaps, Institute for Government. A lot of these organizations are at most 15, maybe 20 years old, if you want to really dip deeply. So the apolitical service creates a weak think tank sector, because you don't have a need to find jobs for the boys and girls when your party's out of office. And as a result, the idea of critically testing policy is also weak. And this means that the last thing you ever want to see is simulation and gaming and forcing people to confront the reality that their linear conception of plans succeeding is not always going to work. Simulation and gaming forces people to say what other courses of action are possible, what other sets of events are going to create outcomes, and it forces people to confront the idea that what they think ought to happen isn't going to happen. We know, and I say we here, I guess I'm thinking, we historians, or people who listen to historians, know that things never go the way we expect them to. Military theorists who listen to Moltke the Elder saying that no plan ever survives with any degree of certainty more than 24 hours after contact with the enemy main body, this idea of the unplanned, something which is intuitive to so many people who are working at policy implementation, is something which is very difficult for people to include in their conception of policy development. And because gaming and simulation bring that in, gaming and simulation are something to be, to some extent, afraid of. So why didn't the Canadian commander back in the 1990s, commanding a notional corps, why didn't that commander include wargaming? Why is there not time for wargaming? To some extent, it's because most of that process involved making PowerPoint presentations and developing them and delivering them. And of course, PowerPoint is arguably nowadays it has become a principle of war. But there is more to it. And that is that if you're conducting operations in a complex nonlinear environment, as all military operations are, or if you're trying to make government policy in other areas, national security, or indeed the more routine quarters of government policy, the complexity and non-linearity of the real world, which govern all of your outcomes, are sometimes most easily ignored. Because if you pay attention to the complexity and non-linearity, then you are forced to face the possibility that what you want to achieve is not possible. And what does this mean for the profession, as it were, of wargaming? And I say this because we have, here we are at a professional wargaming conference. We have a very clear idea, most of us, what the difference is between professional wargaming and hobby wargaming. It's an idea that's really important to the profession of wargaming because otherwise we can't justify getting paid to do it. The idea that there is a professional approach to wargaming is one that is familiar to many. Having myself stood in the old rooms where the Camberley Kriegsspiel was played, and having seen the artifacts of more than a century of professional wargaming, I have no illusions that it is anything other than a solid professional, a solid profession. And yet, consulting professionals as part of policy development so often does not involve consulting simulators and gamers. The wargaming and simulation profession needs to continue to sell simulation to think tanks and university politics departments. The inclusion of gaming and simulation is still far too dependent on the creative department head, the creative reader, or the hungry senior lecturer who wishes to introduce innovation and excitement into postgraduate programs. It is excellent that is so successful when it happens, but is problematical when it does not happen all the time. So I can admire the MA program at Brunel that includes simulation in their, includes crisis simulation, but I also have to shake my head at departments elsewhere where that is not a routine part of what they do. The profession has to sell the idea of demanding simulations. That is, the profession must demand and convince others to demand simulation and gaming as a routine part of procurement. We are, to some extent, I would suggest, comfortable with gaming as part of doctrinal development. But of course, in the UK defense world in particular, and I'll say this to a room full of DSTL people, in the UK defense environment in particular, doctrinal development, to some extent, exists as a horse to pull procurement. And deciding whether one has doctrine in order to, say, know how to fight, or doctrine in order to know how to resupply, is a little bit radical in a world in which doctrine is there in order to justify purchasing platforms and systems. But this odd reality, the reality that doctrine and procurement are oddly connected, is also potentially an opportunity. That is, gaming and simulation does have its foot in that door and needs to push the door open wider. So for the profession of simulation and gaming, the idea that teaching people to manage the risk of discontinuity, teaching people to manage the risk of discontinuous events disrupting their policy or strategy reality, that is, enabling people to manage the predictive aspects, but also all of the other non-linearities in their world, is something that gaming and simulation can offer. And it's something which, it is an offer which is all too seldom taken up. So I guess the most straightforward thing I can say is to a room full of people who are either pros, old pros, or those aspiring to be pros in the gaming and simulation world, take up a challenge to sell the simulation not only on its internal merits, but also because it is a corrective to some of the worst pathologies in UK government. Having senior people go into significant government departments at the very top level, having people become foreign secretary and go into an environment where they think they're going to be able to affect change, execute policy, God help us, make strategy. People who try to do that and fail need help. And the professional wargamer, regardless of what their what it says on the certificate hanging on their wall, whether they're a psychologist, whether they're a behavioral scientist, regardless of what their multidisciplinary inputs to it are, need to be able to take their ability, turn that into credibility, and force people to use it. Because otherwise, we'll continue to wallow in the mire of linear conceptions of a non-linear world, and we will continue to have unrealistic policy that does not achieve its aims and produces confusion, disruption, and economic dislocation. And that's all I have to say about that.